Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We are owners of several of Seattle's finest restaurants. I happen to have 16 here, 16 food businesses here in downtown Seattle. And we are hoping that they don't put a car tax on when you come down. Now they're talking about a car tax.
So. I know.
My city is double-crossing me.
Well, they're not making it easy, that's for sure.
We have the Lola restaurant downstairs, Dahlia across the street, Palace Kitchen, Carlisle Room. We got a bunch of them.
Cuoco.
And, of course, we're coming to you from our cooking school, the Hot Stove Society, where we do many different things, lots of business team buildings, and certainly we have a full schedule of social classes, too, like Masa Maniacs and how to make pizza and... once a month, we have a coconut cream pie class and all sorts of lovely things like that.
Dang, that want to be a class. And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef owner of Luc in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle at the corner of 6th and Union at the bottom of the Sheraton Grand.
Nice. We're going to be with you for 2 hours today. Please hang for the whole show. We got the Baker's Corner coming up with Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery. We're going to share our tips and tricks on buying new and used cast iron skillets. Why would you buy a used cast? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Why would you buy a used cast iron skillet? Because used or new, what's the difference? You're going to season the pan and then you're going to go keep cooking with it.
I have a good reason why you would buy it. So I'm just
because you're afraid of what was in there before your chicken.
No. I said I have a good reason to buy. Used cast iron skillet. We're going to host a dinner party using the same leafy greens in every course. Sean, are you hosting our party tonight? Sean's going to be our producer today.
Sure, yes. I will host this party tonight.
Way
I love
to be prepared
parties.
There, yes. Sean.
We get you, didn't we?
And, of course, we're going to go toe-to-toe on Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. I have been getting crushed lately. I feel like a fall grape.
I've won 5 straight questions for the last 3 weeks. I think I need to calm down today.
You need to take a break.
I'm a little bit tired, so I'll be fine.
First, let's jump into ordinary to extraordinary. Chef, how would you take a normal salad dressing? So I'm going to say, well...
Don't say something you buy in a store.
That would be normal for most people.
No, that's not normal. That's something.
Excuse me, audience. Is buying salad dressing normal for most people? Yes.
All right. So
how would you take that normal Italian vinaigrette in the store and make it extraordinary?
So I would take what's in your fridge, put it in the garbage, and then start from fresh. I mean, geez. It's 2019. We need to get to the basics. Dressings are very simple. The reason you buy it in a store is so it can stay in your fridge for another year. You don't need to have a dressing for a year. Just make enough for another week or two, and that's plenty. And you just use an acid, a binder, and an oil, right? That's the basis of any dressing. So you can use red wine vinegar or lemon juice. Then you use a little bit of Dijon mustard. Mix the two together really well, and then take some oil and drop it gently in there. It can be olive oil. It can be whatever oil you want to use, avocado oil, or, you know, just pick a good oil you like, a flavor you like, and mix those three things together. And then you shake it really good. You season it salt and pepper. You have a dressing. And that's your go-to dressing because that's the dressing you have in the fridge in a little jar this big, and you've made enough dressing for a week. You don't need to have dressing in your fridge for 6 months. That is completely no good. You don't need to do that.
This was really fun. Let's move on.
Then you can also do more like a soy base. You can use soy sauce, Dijon mustard, and sesame oil, toasted sesame oil. Now you've got a more like Asian style kind of dressing, right? So you've got the lemon, mustard, and olive oil.
I think the question was, how do you take an ordinary dressing and make it extraordinary? And I think you touched on something that people could do. Let's say you have your Italian vinaigrette in the fridge that most people have other than you. And now you maybe you're going to make, say, a Thai beef salad or something like that. You don't have to. You can just doctor up that Italian dressing with a little soy sauce, a little sesame oil, and a little chili paste. And you have the basis, a quick, fast, easy vinaigrette based on what's in your
kitchen. Or you could start from scratch, like I said.
Yeah. Okay, popsicles. I know you love popsicles.
I have no idea. No, I don't do popsicles.
Yeah, we do popsicles. So one of our favorite things for our kitchen teams is we go in the middle of the hot summer shifts. You know, even though kitchens tend to have air conditioning, they're hot as hell in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You know, summertime. And so we often go get Otter Pops or something like that for breaks, just to have a little something cold. But if you're going to make your own popsicles.
That's easy. Just make juice. Make juice,
right?
Out of any fruit you find, and then put that in the freezer, and you've got popsicle. I mean, popsicle is basically a juice that's been frozen, right? It's very simple. And
most popsicles are sugar water that's been frozen.
Correct. Most popsicle you buy, just like the dressing, not necessarily so good. But if you make it your own, you now own it. And I would recommend taking your juice and put some mint or put some basil or put some fresh herbs in there, since you get both of them in your garden at the same time or at the market at the same time. Just combine the two together. So now you have a gorgeously flavored juice. Let's say you take peach juice. You know, peach are going to be in season soon. Just take a bunch of peach, put them in your blender. You can actually have a popsicle that has actually texture to it, where you keep the pulp inside and then put some fresh herbs in there, like a lemon verbena or something like this. Let it seep in there and then remove it, put it in your freezer, put the whole thing in your freezer, and you've got a wonderful popsicle.
Yeah, anise hyssop is a good
flavor. Oh, yeah, anise hyssop. That's
flavor,
absolutely.
For fruit. Okay, and then sweet tea.
Sweet tea goes really well with vodka. that's one thing I like. But the problem with sweet tea that I don't like is it's always too sweet for me. I'm not a big sweet guy like that.
And even what I consider authentic sweet teas. So there's, you know, I'm not trying to be judgmental, but like the tea in the South where everyone has sweet tea.
Too sweet.
To me, it's just like drinking soda pop, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
But when you have sweet tea, say, in the Middle East, mm-hmm. where it's just pounded mint,
a lot of sugar,
hot water.
Morocco, man, they made some incredible.
That's a
mint
little different.
Tea. Very different. First of all, the mint is the secret of the tea, not anything else. Mm. It's really all about the mint. And they have this mint that they use, and they crush it, and they just put hot water on it and sugar.
And, but a lot of sugar.
Oh, yeah. They put a lot of sugar. The sweetness is definitely high. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you cut that down with a little bit of lemon juice, and you take a lemon, you squeeze it in there. Right away, that cuts down that level of sugar, of sweetness. It doesn't cut down the sugar, but it cut down the sweetness in the palate, so you have something a little bit more. And then, again, you're making it yourself, so make a little bit less.
Okie doke. Up next, questions from you, our trusty listeners, right here on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Okay, we're back in the kitchen. It's the Hot Stove Society. Still got lots of show coming up here. We are going to jump right into questions from our listeners. You know, sometimes they're right here in the audience, and sometimes they're from our Facebook page. If you want to put a question up, just go to the Facebook at Seattle Kitchen and leave us a little question. We'll try and get it on the air and try and answer it thoughtfully, not flippantly like you sometimes do.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
I would never do that. Anyway, a young man came up from the audience. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You bought your mother this for Mother's Day. You are a nice man.
Yeah,
thank you.
Very
thoughtful.
Exactly.
She better cherish you. I don't know.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You ever have you ever made her dinner or anything like that?
Yeah. Well, actually, last night. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your What do you own? What dish do you own, Nathan?
You know, I really like to do ribs on my charcoal grill, but haven't done that yet this year.
Not yet. Okay.
Yeah.
But what makes them special? Why are your ribs better than my ribs?
Ooh. Well, I haven't tried your ribs, but I really like to use a Carolina sauce too.
Uh-huh.
And then I do hickory charcoal usually.
Nice.
3 hours or so. Yeah.
Perfect. And baby backs or spare ribs?
You know, I usually mix it up every other.
Yeah.
I prefer baby back myself.
Yeah. They're so tender.
Yeah,
so
they're
good.
So nice.
Okay,
yeah.
You have a question for us today.
So I have a fig tree, and every year I get hundreds of figs, mm-hmm. way more than I know what to do with. Mm-hmm. And I try preserving them, and I can just never get it to work. I tried making jams. They don't turn out well. I've tried drying them, and it just doesn't turn out. What recommendations do you have?
So go ahead.
What kind of fig tree?
They're
like green.
No, they're purple.
They're purple.
Yeah.
Ah, when they're ripe, they're purple.
Yes.
The
mission
figs. Those are delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And you've tried a dehydrator.
Yeah, but we have to slice them at least half, usually more, and so then they get kind of just chewy and not very good.
Not so good.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's the story with the jam? How come the jam doesn't come out?
Well, I think it's because I used underripe figs for it because I was worried they would fall apart.
So the flavor wasn't good.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, yeah, so just you know, pick your figs when you can, mm-hmm. preferably before they fall off.
Before the birds get them.
Before the birds get them, yeah. And then put them on the cookie sheet or, you know, on flat ground, and then let them ripen. Okay. I mean, it will keep on cooking, on the sugar will keep building up a little bit for a while, and then you'll have wonderful ripe figs.
I don't know if that's true, chef.
Okay. I don't know if it's true either, but just try it. How's that?
Well, I just don't know how. Honestly, you can't add any more sugar.
So the other solution to that is cut your figs in half or quarter, add some sugar, put some fresh herbs in there from the garden. And I can tell you probably have some garden and you probably have some fresh herb in there, like mint or whatever flavor you want to add to your figs. And then let them macerate for a day.
Okay.
So they will render all that juice and they will have all that beautiful flavor added to it. Then cook that down slowly. Add a little port to your fig.
Port, that's a good idea.
A good ruby port, like mm-hmm. a dark port.
Or cream sherry, either one.
Yeah. Put it in there and then cook your figs down really slowly. Grate some oranges at the end. You'll have a beautiful fig jam and then put it into some little cans and sterilize them and be done. Okay. And I think also figs, I was going to say pickled fig. You know, you take whole figs and you just put them in a nice pickling juice for an overnight.
You know, what do you consider a nice pickling juice? Is that one salt, one vinegar, one water?
No, it's 3-2-1. It's a basic combination of 3 water, 2 sugar, 1 vinegar. Right?
Okay.
3-2-1.
Yeah.
And you add peppercorns.
You put spices you put spices in there, cinnamon. You can put a cinnamon stick. You can put clove, juniper, bay leaf. And then you bring that to a boil. Let it steep for maybe an hour.
How firm do you think they need to be to begin with? Because my figs really, they're falling apart when I pick them off the tree when they're ripe.
Oh, you're a lucky man that the birds aren't taking those first.
I know.
You get
you're
to
very
them,
lucky. But get in there another couple of days earlier.
Okay.
Instead of waiting till they're ripe. So, you know, you can pickle a lot. And then you can make gift for people. You know, you buy...
Perfect.
Smaller jar, and then you can give it away for, you know, Christmas or whatever holiday you want to pick.
Mother's Day.
There we go. I have to wait another year.
But he only has one mother. That's going to be a big jar.
All right. Nice job. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you so much.
You're a strong radio man. Okay. Julie has a question from our Facebook page saying, I worry about the safety of chicken. Where is the best place to purchase it? So, us not being scientists, we just know how we're supposed to handle it in our restaurants.
Right.
I don't know from a purchasing it perspective if there's anything, any place safer than another other than a clean store.
Yeah.
But from a handling perspective, I would say most people aren't anywhere close to handling it as well as, say, we do in the restaurants,
right.
in their own kitchens, right? So if you put it into a sink, and a lot of people rinse their chicken, which to me, you're just spreading the chicken germs all over the place when you do that because you're not then bleaching down your sink afterwards. So I put it on a board. I put any sort of juices down a sink where I'm going to have bleach water. And then I cut it up, do my thing with it. And then I take my board and my knife and I run it through a dishwasher that has a sterilizing cycle.
Correct.
Right? If you don't have that, then you need to wipe them down with bleach water.
Correct.
Bleach water is one, I
one
think
cap.
It's about one,
one
I know
cap.
One cap, but that's not even a half ounce, I don't think. It's about a half ounce to a gallon of cool water, not cold and not hot, but cool water, and that'll last for about 4 hours in your kitchen. And when you're at home cooking, it's not a bad idea to start with a little bucket, make it a red bucket so that you know what it is. And just have that bleach water at the beginning of your cooking adventures, and then wipe down your surfaces with
this,
that. When
this
you're
is
done.
What's required for us in the restaurant industry is to start that way. We but, start but service it, like
yeah.
that. We
but
start
even if
day.
You put gloves on, right, and then you take the gloves off, you're handling your dirty glove with your clean fingers. And
gloves are misleading in many ways because you don't remember you have gloves on, and now you're starting to touch your fridge, your chicken, your all kind of different things, and the cash at the cash register.
And you go over to your sink and you turn on the faucet with your gloves, hands that aren't washed. I mean, there's just a lot of ways to spread it.
Right.
So to be most careful, wipe down everything when you're done with a little bleach water, and you're set.
Use lots of water when you're cooking. You should have a sink right next to you, and just use lots of water and rinse off everything off.
All right, Mary wants to know some ideas for lovage and French sorrel, with a question mark, French sorrel.
So sorrel, you can make a nice soup with sorrel. You just take a little butter, It always starts with butter, by the way. You melt it down, throw in your sorrel, throw in a little vegetable stock or chicken stock on top of that. Sorrel is like spinach. It disappears in your pot, so don't be afraid to use some. But it is 100% more strong than spinach. It's like lemon. That's what sorrel tastes like. So don't put too much. Melt it down, put a little stock on top of that, dash of cream, blend the whole thing up, and you will have a wonderful little sorrel sauce, soup. It doesn't take very long. The base, again, is to have a good stock ready to go, and then you mix the two together, and then you've got it. If you don't want cream, you don't need cream. You can finish it with olive oil in your blender, and that's the same thing.
So what are you saying as amount of sorrel to cream to make a sorrel soup? Because I would say it's a lot of cream.
Yeah, it's a good amount of cream, but you don't have to put cream. You could actually use your stock. Just put your stock on top of
but
that.
But then how do you keep it from turning gray?
Don't worry about that. It's not about the color. It's about the flavor. I mean, you know, you can cheat and put a bunch of spinach in there and everything will be bright green. But that's the point is that you're trying to make a sorrel soup, not a...
spinach and sorrel soup.
Yeah, you're not trying to do a spinach and sorrel.
I prefer, personally, a spinach and sorrel soup.
Yeah.
Because I find too much sorrel overwhelming and not very
Correct.
Interesting.
Sorrel is very powerful. It's like lemon. So you have to cut it down. That's where the cream comes in, Andy, because it softens down that brightness of acid and tame it down a little bit, but still keeps that flavor in the background. So it's really delicious.
So if you want to keep your soup green, take your spinach, blanch it, cool it off, squeeze it out, and then put that spinach bomb into your sorrel, into the blender,
into the blender, yes. And you'll have a bright
green
soup.
That spinach bomb will definitely brighten up your soup.
Yep.
Okay, there's so many fresh herbs available right now. Our garden in Prosser is packed with them. We're going to talk about how to properly pick, store, and eat them on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We're here at the Hot Stove Society doing the Seattle Kitchen Show. You can join us like these lovely folks did just by going to hotstovesociety.com, checking out the radio show schedule, and coming on down. $20, you're in for a breakfast sandwich, hot coffee.
Great company.
We'll even throw in tea if you want tea instead.
And great company.
And great company, exactly. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
Okay, chefy in the hattie.
Yes.
Let's talk herbs. My wife is gone crazy on herbs right now. And one of the things that she does over at our farm in Prosser is she has built raised beds for every herb variety, which really controls them, right? Because herbs like to spread.
Right.
And so we have, I think, 20 raised beds with, you know, one with lovage, one with chives, one with tarragon, rosemary, all of the above. And so, of course, they are kicking it right now. Spring herbs are very different than late summer herbs.
Correct.
And especially different than winter herbs.
Right.
So what's your favorite time of year for the herb season? Or do you like
the variety
as it all goes through?
I like the month that's coming up.
June?
Yeah, because it's the month where everything starts sprouting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you get the... yesterday I did a rover's pop-up. From my own garden, I brought oregano, sage blossom, bronze fennel frond, and roses, which, by the way, are edible. And
as long as they're not sprayed with insecticides.
Well, from your garden, obviously. Yeah. You know what you're doing in your garden. And then mint. And thyme blossom. So this is the time of the year where you use all this stuff. You go in your garden, if you have a garden, and you go through all the plants and all the blossom, chive blossom, I forgot to mention that. All these things are so fabulous. You make an arugula salad and you put all these herbs, herb top on in your salad. And it's really a flavor enhancer. And why not? Use it. You have it in your garden. You know, mine is well, use it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very beautiful thing to do as a salad. It's also great to use as a garnish. Let's say you're steaming a piece of halibut or some brand new salmon that just came into season, you know, and you can sprinkle the whole thing with a bunch of thyme blossom, for example, after it's been grilled. Mix that with a little bit of olive oil and sea salt and put that as a garnish on top of your salmon. And it's really delicious. Now, you only take the blossom because you don't want to put any stem of thyme because that's too hard. You know, but the tender part of the blossom, and they're full of flavor. Same with the sage blossom. You pick the blue, purple sage blossom out of the sage sticks, and then you put that on top of. meat or whatever you're doing.
I think that's probably the number one thing. I'm sure I've said this on this show before, but the number one thing people forget to do with their soft herbs,
right?
The things like basil leaves, mint leaves, tarragon, copper fennel or regular fennel fronds, chives. I mean, there's just a million of them.
Yeah.
Not rosemary, not thyme.
Right.
Right, but not sage leaves. They're too potent. But all those softer herbs, Thai basil, to mix those into your salad greens as whole little leaves, just like the salad is a leaf, I think that's something that people miss out on. And I didn't understand that concept very well until the Vietnamese food revolution happened here in Seattle.
They're the king of putting herbs in every salad.
Yeah, exactly. And it's I never really thought much about that. I always put it into my dressing, but I didn't really put the whole leaves into my salad. And you know, so much of our salad greens these days are tasteless. They're pretty.
Oh, yeah.
There's lots of color going on.
Especially those mixed wild green, whatever they call it.
Yeah, there's just not much flavor going on, even baby spinach and stuff like that. So these herbs really brighten up the entire salad, and I love it. And when you combine that, say, another Vietnamese trick is to take your roasted shallots or your roasted onions or toasted shiitakes or something and put these little toasted numbers into your salad along with your fresh herbs for crunch. For intensity of flavor, like a roasted shiitake mushroom, a thin sliced roasted shiitake mushroom has so much flavor compared to just a raw shiitake mushroom,
right? Of course.
A shallot that you've sliced thinly and put into a pan with some vegetable oil and just let it go low and slow until they turn golden in color.
Golden.
You can even take them all the way to black if you like that bitterness. Because it does, it adds bitter.
Right.
If you got a honey sesame dressing and you put a blackened shallot in there, it really balances out the dressing
the
in a way that
absolutely.
It's very interesting. So that, to me, was a trick learning from the Vietnamese immigrants that came through our kitchens back in the late 70s, early
80s. Using the Thai, the cilantro, the basil, the cilantro, the mint.
The mint.
You know, they use it. And mint is something that most people don't use at home. They look at mint as, it's the garnish you put on top of a cake, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's only relegated to dessert.
You know, mint is very strong, obviously, but you take the leaves and you slice them thin, you sprinkle it into a salad, and you get those little bites from time to time when you're biting on your lettuce, and you go, wow, that's really nice. It's an enhancer. You know, it's very... Same with lemon. If you're going to use lemon juice, grate your lemon, you know, grate your lemon on top of your salad, and then use the juice. Mm-hmm. You know, so you use the entire lemon, but you have... beautiful flavor of zest into your lettuce.
Which is where the real lemoniness comes from.
Exactly.
Right, the lemon acid flavor comes
from
the
oil,
juice.
All on the skin. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting about all those sorts of things. But another good place for your spring herbs, your leafy kind of fresh garden herbs, not the harder herbs like rosemary, is like green goddess dressing, right?
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about vinaigrettes earlier.
Yeah.
But green goddess dressing is a delight. For any sort of salad, and all you're doing is you're typically like a ranch dressing with lots of green herbs, right? So a ranch dressing is 50% mayonnaise, 50% buttermilk, and then just start adding the flavor profile that you want from there. Fresh ground pepper, salt, get that stuff out of the way, toasted coriander seed, and then just all the green herbs that you have, put it in a blender, and you end up with green goddess, right? That's what it is.
Delicious dressing.
You might throw an avocado in there to kind of give it some viscosity.
Yeah.
But it'll turn gray in minutes if you put too much avocado in there. So that's
I like to make that sense.
Put it over avocado.
Similar dressing, but just buttermilk. Uh-huh. And then apple vinegar or tarragon vinegar. I make a tarragon vinegar with tarragon and basil and chives. And then put the whole thing together into a dressing. And it's the same thing as what we were talking about dressing earlier. You make a buttermilk dressing like this. You make a little bit more, obviously more than what you need. You make a good batch and keep it in your refrigerator. It will keep for a few days, especially because the acid will not deteriorate the herbs as strongly as if you were just chopping herbs. Mm-hmm. So it'd be delicious to have in your refrigerator. Put that on top of a piece of salmon. Put that in your salad. Put that in many different places, sandwiches. If you're making a sandwich, use that as a base a little bit on your toasted bread. It's really delicious.
So let's talk about storing herbs for those same kind of leafy, fragile herbs, right? So for me, I get a bunch of basil from the store or from the farmer's market. I'm only going to use half. What do I do with the rest of it? For me, I take a paper towel and I moisten it.
Yep.
Not soaking wet, but moisten it. And then I roll my herbs up in the paper towel. And then I put it into some sort of airtight or Ziploc bagged, and it'll last for quite a while.
I have nothing to say, but this is exactly how you should do it.
Wow, we've been doing this show for a very long time, and I don't know that that has ever happened before.
That's how I do it, so...
Yeah, so happy. The other thing you can do for parsley and cilantro is just trim a half inch off the ends, put it into a glass of water, and pop the whole glass into your fridge,
yeah,
and it'll last 3, 4, 5 days.
And even on your windowsill, you don't necessarily... If you have Italian parsley or flat parsley in your garden, you cut a few and you have too many, you just put it on your windowsill. It doesn't even need to be refrigerated. You know, we use refrigeration... For everything, but
for
if
good
you,
reason, I think.
But if you remember, 70 years ago, there was no refrigeration in most places, and there's still some places where there's no refrigeration. And I'm not saying don't put anything in the fridge. I'm talking about fresh herbs and fresh things like this. You cut them off, you put in a glass of water, and you keep them on your counter. It will keep for a few days, unless your kitchen is 100 degrees, it will kill it. But in a normal home, you will be able to keep it on the counter, and it will stay perfectly fine and fresh.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing to do with leafy herbs, and I think it's been relegated to mint, but you can do basil, you can do rosemary here, you can do things like that. But put a muddler in there and kind of bruise it up with some ice cubes. And next thing you know, you're making a mint julep, you're making a daiquiri, you're making a, what's the one with mint and rum? Mojito. Things like that.
And you can also do tea. You know, infusions of fresh herbs is so delicious. Just put a little drop of honey in there with your fresh herbs and then pour in some hot water. Let it steep for maybe 10 minutes. Remove everything. Strain it through a coffee filter.
That's a long time, chef. It's going to be cold tea by the time they get done.
I'm not trying to make hot tea. I wasn't finished.
Okay.
You see, you interrupted me. Anyway, strain the whole thing through a coffee filter and use that as an iced tea.
Okay, I agree. Make sure you use some things that are not necessarily what we consider herbs, but use them like herbs. Arugula works beautifully, like basil does, right? One's considered more of a leafy green, the other's considered an herb, but they work in the same fashion, whether it's pesto or whatever. So
garnishes on your dishes.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's pea sprouts. That seems to be the hottest thing going is pea sprouts. Okay. We got a big guy coming up here. Andy Ricker is going to join us. He's got a new book out called Noodles, Pok Pok Noodles. And if you've never been to Pok Pok in Portland, it has become a national mainstay for chicken wings and noodles and all sorts of deliciousness. So he's going to be with us next on Skype as we head out on the Seattle Kitchen Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
And we have a special guest, Andy Richter, is here. Or I just called him Andy Richter. It's Ricker.
Ricker.
Andy Ricker is here. He's got a new book, Pok Pok Noodles. And if you live in Seattle and you go to Portland every once in a while, my guess is you've been to Pok Pok down there in the southeast, I believe. Is that right, Andy?
Correct. And it's funny, the Andy Richter thing that happens all the time. We get mistaken for each other constantly on Twitter, much to my chagrin and his amusement.
So, your restaurant is infamous. You've gone on to great things in your career. It's exciting to have you on the show. Your book is astonishingly beautiful, I think. The photography is great and alive. And I think that's the hardest thing to do in cookbooks sometimes is to make the food come alive. Everyone wants to style food to death. But I feel like your book brings the food alive. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. We have a very good team. We've done all three books together. It's myself, J.J. Good is my co-writer, and then Austin Bush is the photographer. And then also there's a fourth member of the team that doesn't get mentioned much, and he's the guy who does the work on the photos after they've been taken, the post-production part. And, the great thing is that Austin is a 20-year resident of Thailand. And so not only is he a good photographer, but he really understands the material. So you're not trying to explain to somebody why there shouldn't be chopsticks or a lime on the plate or whatever. He knows the food, and he instinctually gets the right shot that shows it off the best.
Yeah, and those are my favorite shots, too, are the live ones from around the world or from Thailand itself. They're just... I'm jealous. I've never been to Thailand. It's on my bucket list. I can't wait to go. But in the meantime, I'm going to buy your book called Pak Pak Noodles and kind of cook my way through it. It looks delicious.
Excellent.
Where does one start? If I buy your book, where do I start, Andy?
Where do you start? You mean like what thing should you try to cook first?
Correct.
Okay, so on the cover of the book, there's a bowl of noodles, and that's called Kwetiau Namkai, which means chicken noodle soup. And the reason I chose that to be the cover of the book was, first, it's a nice shot with nice colors and stuff. But second of all, it's kind of the most simple expression of a Thai soup noodle. It's also very, very satisfying, and it's very easy to make. So I feel like that is kind of what the best way to get into this book is to start with that recipe. It's very simple. You just have to make a nice chicken stock. You have to start with some good chicken, and then it's very simply seasoned, and you choose your noodles to go with it. And it's easy to pull off. Everybody will like it, and it's simple.
That's usually what makes a great dish, to be simple and delicious. You know, it's like that's usually what it works in every culture, I think.
Not to get too esoteric here, Andy, but you just said you have to start with a nice chicken. I was in a, I'll call it a Chinatown market over the weekend, having a little dim sum south of Seattle. And this market, I went by the frozen chicken area, and there's these chickens kind of head first in a bag. They actually had been plucked, but they looked like somebody went over to the coop, wrung a neck, and popped it into a bag. And, you know, the feet are hanging out the top of the bag upside down in the freezer case. And they're just like, I was trying to think, who would buy this chicken?
Me.
And then what would you do? And this soup seems perfect for that.
That's exactly the chicken that you want.
Exactly.
So in Thailand, we call that gai ban, which means village chicken. Right. Here they call them, I think, Buddhist walking chicken. Essentially, they're a breed of chicken that's thick-skinned. There's not much fat on them. They're very, very flavorful. And they're just kind of the perfect... You probably don't want to try to make fried chicken out of it. It'd be like eating rubber bands. But they're made for stewing. They're quite expensive, too, because they raise them naturally and kill them. It's not a big factory concern. So... Those are great chicken. If you live in a big city that has halal or Chinese poultry market where you can get freshly killed birds, that's even better.
Right.
You just go and ask them for a Buddhist walking chicken or a stewing chicken.
Boy, I haven't seen that around lately. You know, down in Chinatown in L.A. or places like that where you used to be able to go in, San Francisco, and just cages of live birds and order your bird, and they take it back and handle it for you. And next thing you know, you've got a nice chicken walking out of the store. Do they still have those kind of markets in this country?
Sure. I'm in Chinatown, L.A. right now, and within a 1-minute walk from the front of the plaza, I'm in. There are two poultry markets that will do that. I also live in Brooklyn, Chinatown, and there's several live poultry markets there as well as Manhattan. And anywhere where there's a large Chinese population, there's usually one of these markets. I guess depending on what the regulations for the city are as far as health and all that kind of stuff. The smell's a little bit intense. So the first time you go, it might be a little off-putting, but it is the best way to get the freshest poultry available.
All right, let's move on from chicken soup. Maybe a couple other top favorite recipes in your new book called Noodles, Pak Pak Noodles.
Sure. So moving from the soup noodles to a kind of a fried noodle, I would suggest maybe doing the, well, there's a few different ones that make sense for the home cook, but I think the sukiyaki or dry sukiyaki noodle is a really great dish to cook at home. And another thing about it is that it really appeals to Westerners, I think, because it has a lot of vegetables in it. And that typically, that's a little unusual for most Thai noodles, is to have tons of vegetables in it. This one has a kind of a melange of vegetables, some glass noodles, egg, protein, pork, usually pork or shrimp, and then a really deeply umami-rich sauce that involves fermented tofu and a few other things. And I really recommend that one. It's quite easy to make on a stovetop, just using a nonstick wok pan. So that would be a good one to try, I think.
Yum.
Another one, yeah, and then another one to do a different category would be bami hang, which is a wheat noodle done dry style, meaning there's no soup in the noodle itself, but it's also not fried. You basically make, it's more like a salad almost. You boil the noodles and you prepare the proteins and the various different things to flavor it, and you just throw it into a bowl and mix it up. And you serve a little bowl of consomme or broth on the side. But really, it's a really common way of eating noodles in Thailand, dry style, that you don't see here as often.
Sounds so delicious. The new book is called Pok Pok Noodles. Andy Ricker is the author with J.J. Good. Pok Pok is a restaurant down in Portland. Also, you've opened a couple other locations around the country.
I did, but I've closed them.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I had some in New York and some in L.A., but I'm done with those. I pulled up roots in both of those cities, even though I'm in L.A. right now on book tour. And now it's just Portland. We've got six restaurants in Portland, and we've got one licensing deal at the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas for our Pok Pok wing counter service model. And that's what we got now.
All right.
Good for you.
If you don't get to go to Portland, this book is the next best thing. I would suggest you find it anywhere online or at a bookstore. 10 Speed Press is the publisher. And we will talk to Andy again soon. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society right here in downtown Seattle. We're thankful that you're here. We've got another whole hour to go in the show, which includes cast iron thoughts and meals. Also, Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery will be here for the Baker's Corner. And then I'm not sure who's going to take us on in our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, but I'm feeling at a weak point
I'm pretty sure
trivia
we'll find
career.
Somebody.
Yeah. I think that won't be a problem.
They're always ready to get us.
And they always want to take advantage when we're down.
Yeah, I'm tired today, too.
I know, exactly. Okay, Taste of the Week. Let's first jump into tacos, because on one of our shows a few weeks ago, we talked about our favorite taco places, and our Facebook page went crazy with over 100 suggestions of where people should go and who is serving the best tacos. And some of my favorite directions on how to get there, like Michelle Louis Christensen's Raliberto's in Everett, you know, behind the KFC. That's her directions on how to get there.
Well, there must be only one KFC in Everett. Good for them.
Mike Ross says Carmelo's Tacos on the hill. There's seven hills in Seattle. It's like the Cap Hill, First Hill, West Seattle Hill.
I have a funny feeling he means Cap Hill.
Yeah, I think so too. Polly Peterson Lang says Masa in Issaquah.
Issaquah used to have five shops. Now they get, it's a big city now.
Yeah, now it's a big deal out there. We've got Nicholas Hanratty, La Costa Taqueria. He's actually very good with directions. 128th and I-5 South in Everett. Cheap and damn good.
That's a great recommendation.
Kevin Hedegaard Klein just tried to... Try Dottie's Double Wide in White Center. Very good tacos. Now, do you think a taco tastes better if it comes out of a truck, a bus, or a trailer, or a double wide?
Not necessarily tastes better.
I think mentally it tastes better.
I think there is a little thing going on in our head that, oh, look at that. It's so cute. Mom and pop in a truck serving you tacos. Mm-hmm. It's got to be good.
Right. Except when it's not.
Except when they go shop in the wrong place and buy the cheapest thing they can possibly find, and sometimes you get disappointed.
Yeah. Okay.
And sometimes they don't actually know how to cook. They just put it together because that's what you're supposed to do. So, yeah, you know, they just have a little difference on that. So.
Rosie Ryder or Reader says, Fonda La Katrina in Georgetown and Agua Verde in the U District.
Love.
I think Fonda La Katrina it's got to be close to the best Mexican restaurant in Seattle, I think. So.
They make those tortillas right in front of you. And, oh,
yeah.
Fabulous.
Really good. That's right down across from the home of France Chocolates. Delicious area. Delicious drive right through Georgetown. Margie Plunkett, macho taco. Yum, she says. That's
where is that?
I don't know, Margie. Thanks for sharing. I have no idea where macho taco is. Vincent Caron says, my favorite is from my own kitchen. They cost way less to cook than my fajitas and soft tacos, and the fillings leftovers make great omelets.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how many people that are making tacos in their own kitchen are actually making tortillas? Because to me, that's the sign of a good taco, generally a homemade tortilla. So I am a bit biased on those ones where you see the little kind of half-steamed. Well, you can even see the machine rollers still on the tortilla. Come on. Charge 50 cents more and make your own tacos.
Exactly.
Make your own tortillas.
Well, make it at home. It's very fun to make tortillas. I mean...
Kyle Fletcher says, no traditional tacos, but La Cabana on North 105th is as good as you're going to get.
That's La Cabana. You see that little thing on the end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that thing,
Spanish.
Yeah. Okay.
Just saying.
Thank you for that, Chef. And I think North 105th, is that off of Aurora there? Is that where that is?
Maybe. I mean, North 105.
Anyway, thanks for going on to our Facebook page and telling us all about your favorite taquerias and all that sort of thing. So, also, Terry Benson, haven't had their tacos yet, but had a brunch and other meals that rocked at El Camion in Seattle. And Ballard, must rock. They were at Zesto's Drive-In there, I believe. Mm-hmm. And now they've moved down to the old Chinese restaurant, Mr. Chen's, on Elliott. Because I think the Zesto's Drive-In is getting redeveloped into apartments or something like that. Is that true? I'm getting a yes from the audience. Good job. So there's some taquerias for you to try if you're in the taco hunt. I think of tacos kind of like pizza and barbecue. There's always like a contest going on.
There's always a million choices, too.
Well, there's a million choices, but people always want to have the best one. You know, it's like we learned that at Sirius Pie when we first opened. It's like a national game adventure of finding the best pizza in America.
So, it is. Yeah. So it's just like the best burger, yeah.
Yeah. So people don't say that about where's the best piece of halibut? They don't feel the same way about it.
Exactly. It's just not as popular, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, favorite taste of the week, Chef. What have you come up with? We only have two minutes.
Yesterday we did a Rover's pop-up spring, and I did a roll of Dungeness crab with avocados and cucumbers. And I made a nice little jelly of, like a seafood jelly out of the halibut bones that I had and some crab leftover of the shell and everything. I made a nice little stock, and I reduced that down very slowly and then put a little gelatin in there to set the whole terrine together, the whole roll together. Add that overnight and then flip it over, and I serve that with a gribiche, which is a classic French sauce of mayonnaise, gherkins, hard-boiled egg, and capers.
Everything kind of like, but potatoes of a potato salad.
Exactly. Yeah. So kind of like, what do you call that? What's that English sauce, American sauce that we make? Yeah, tartar sauce. Thank you. I couldn't remember the name of a tartar
really?
Sauce.
Really? That's just you just made a fancy tartar sauce for your halibut terrine?
Hold on.
Or halibut jelly?
And Tobiko in it for the texture. Tobiko. And that was really, really delicious. I mean, I thought it was very... I don't know what you call it.
Oh, my God. You just looked at me in a way that made me uncomfortable.
Very spring-like, you know.
He looked at me like I looked that delicious.
Where do I start?
Oh, my God. So you do these pop-ups once a quarter. How do people find out about them so that we're not just talking about them after they're done?
I like talking about after because it's always booked. No, go to the Chef in the Hat, the website, chefinthehat.com. And then go up on the Rover's pop-up events and then scroll down. You will see the menu that we've done before. We're at number 14. Mm-hmm. And it's always on a Monday night. Starts at 6:30 p.m. And you will see down when you scroll up on the Rover's pop-up, there is a link to sign up for the emailing list. And you put yourself into that love that kind of dining kind of mailing list and be part of it as well.
Okay, up next, we're going to share our tips and tricks on making a great meal using only one pan. Oh, a little twist on things. I believe it's a cast iron pan. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. All right, we are back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
A few more good segments coming up, so don't leave. We're going to talk right now about making dinner out of using only one pan throughout the evening. And I'm going to start us off.
Okay. I'm waiting.
Are you?
Yes. What kind of pan are you going to use?
We're going to use a cast iron pan. So let's talk about first cast iron pans, right, and why or why not should you buy them used or not, right? There's obviously Lodge makes a huge variety of cast iron pans.
Correct.
One of the cool things about their pans that you buy today is that they're pre-seasoned. You remember buying cast iron pans early on?
Yes.
And putting the oil on, putting them in the oven for 8 hours,
yeah,
and doing all the seasoning work.
Salt.
And then you get it too hot the first time, and it burns the seasoning off, and you have to do it all over again.
Correct.
But these pre-seasoned pans work beautifully. They work a little bit like, you know, the Le Creuset pans,
right,
or the Staub pans that are,
right,
enameled. So they maintain their edge and cook very much the same way as a American-style cast iron pan.
Right.
So I say buy a used one because you're buying its history with the pan. And if you look at the pan, like I keep my mother-in-law's cast iron pan. When she passed, we got her pan. And I look and revel in her history of cooking in that pan with all the burnt-on drips and just the kind of the crustiness of it. It's not crusty as in dirty, but it's crusty as in years and years and years of use. And I find that in this world of throwaway kitchen tools and throw away everything, that cast iron relives your family history in a way that very few other kitchen tools do, because knives wear out. Like if you inherit a knife or maybe even a sifter is probably,
right,
one thing that kind of makes it through the,
right,
the system. But so that's why I would like to either inherit or buy a used cast iron pan. What about you?
Well, I've got three cast iron pans hanging on my pan rack and pot rack in my kitchen, and they're all bought at Goodwill. Three of them in one time. One day I went to Goodwill to drop some stuff. I hate when I go somewhere to drop stuff and I pick up stuff. It's like, wait, you just defeated the purpose here. But I walked in just, you know, giving my stuff away. And then I looked around because I just had a few minutes. And I saw those three cast iron pans. I think it was like $6 or something crazy like that. And I was like, oh, my God, I got to buy those pans. Those are just like you. I was like, those are historical. You know, somebody's been using those pans. Maybe, who knows, maybe 10 different people have used those pans. So I bought the pan and I seasoned them and been using them for probably 15 years, not, mm-hmm, 20 years. And when I die, they can give it away to somebody else, you,
yeah,
know. But those are almost indestructible.
Well, if you've pre-owned them, they're probably worth at least $7 now.
I've raised the value. But no, I mean, I think it's really cool. And I think they're indestructible. They're also, I wouldn't use a cast iron pan to make a sauce, for example, because the liquids in there, when you reduce it down, you pick up some flavor you don't necessarily want. But to sear anything, mm-hmm, a cast iron pan is godsend. I mean, it's like, it's really, really a good piece of equipment. You know, you just have to be patient. When I put it on my stove, I walk away. I come back 15 minutes later to make sure the pan is actually hot, like if I want to sear a steak or something. I do not stay in front of my pan ever.
But you don't want to burn off your seasoning.
No.
I mean, if you're going to use it for blackening like Paul Prudhomme did and the blackening.
That would be a dedicated pan.
But that's a dedicated. I wanted to make that distinction. That's
absolutely
a dedicated pan that you've burnt the surface off and you continue to burn it off every
Correct.
Time you use it.
Once it's burned, you do have to re-season. I mean,
so my first thing that we're going to have for dinner when I invite you over to my house for a little cast iron one pan dinner, I'm going to make cornbread. And I'm going to take my cast iron pan, put some bacon fat in the bottom, and I'm going to pop it into my 450-degree oven. And I'm not talking about some bacon fat. I'm talking about a lot of bacon fat. And then I'm going to pull it out and when it's super hot, and I'm going to pour my cornbread batter into it and put it back in the oven. And it's going to cook in maybe 10 minutes because of the super hot pan. But in that 10 minutes, I got the head start on the browning of the cornbread, right? And then I'm going to pull it out, and when it's warm, I'm going to slather it with butter, and then I'm going to serve you a little bit of the Michter's rye, neat, with our cornbread, and we're going to sit there and get started in a good old-fashioned way.
We might never get finished.
We might never get finished at that. Okay, now the pan is yours.
All right, so I'm going to do sardines. Because
oh,
I love
my God.
Sealed sardines. I have a pan dedicated just for fish, just so it's clear. One is just for fish. But I love
sardines. This is our family heirloom. You're going to put sardines in my family heirloom?
Of course. Your family needs to expand a little bit. So a little bit of duck fat in the pan when the pan is hot, and seal those sardines really well. And then when the sardines are cooked, just put them on the side. And it doesn't take very long to cook a fillet of sardine. It cooks really fast. Then take the fat out and make a quick vinegar and mustard dressing, kind of, but on the spot with the hot fat, and pour that right over the sardines with a little heat in there, harissa or something like
that.
Okay. Ooh.
Now I'm going to wash the pan because it's my course. I'm going to wash the pan for 15 minutes.
And you got to season it.
I'm going to fumigate the house. And I'm going to put it back on
your
the stove.
Your house has seen a lot worse than that. I know that.
I'm going to put it back on the stove. We're going to get it super hot. And I'm going to spatchcock my chicken, which is basically just taking the backbone out and butterflying the chicken. And I'm going to season it super well with salt and pepper and just put it skin side down into my hot pan and going back into my 500-degree oven.
Mm.
But I'm going to put my second cast iron that I own and set it on top of the chicken because that's my brick, right?
Yep,
you know, that's what instead of using a brick, my second pan is my brick. And we're going to pull it out and serve that chicken with a delicious smashed potato, like a mashed potato, but I like the skins in it. Just red skin potatoes, lovely, with my crispy roasted chicken.
Oh.
And it's going to be so good.
And those potatoes.
And those potatoes. And maybe a little steamed asparagus. And now you have dessert in that same pan.
I'm going to do a tartatin, but I'm going to do it with Nathan's figs because we had Nathan on earlier, the first part of the show, and he has a lot of figs. So I'm going to use some of his figs. So make a nice little caramel on the bottom of the pan and then put all those figs laying down on there. A couple of apples, just because I want to put apples in there too. And then put a nice puff pastry on top of that. Put the whole thing in the oven and bake it really well with a little chimney in the middle so the steam comes out. And then when the whole thing is ready, take it out of the pan, flip it upside down, toss the whole thing, you know, pat the whole thing together so it's really smooth and gorgeous looking. And then voila. You know, in the pan I got still a caramel left, nugget of butter and a little bit of port. Remember that port I was telling you? You didn't use the whole bottle. So I'm going to put a little port in there, deglaze. And then use that as a syrup right on top of the tart. And if that's not good, just make some whipped cream with it. It will be delicious.
Yeah. A little whipped cream on that.
Yeah.
Take some of your fresh bay and steep your cream in the bay or with the bay.
Oh, actually, you could use that anise hyssop you have outside and, you know, put it into your cream. It'd be delicious.
So when you do that, you just simply take your anise hyssop or your mint or whatever and bruise it up, pour your cream on top, and let it sit for an hour, and then strain it out, put it into your mixer with some sugar, and make your whipped cream out of that. And you got a nicely scented whipped cream that isn't scented, say, with Grand Marnier or something more traditional.
Sure. So. Oof.
Boy, we made a heck of a meal.
And we did that fast. I mean, those sardines. I'm still tasting those sardines.
Unfortunately, my chicken tastes like sardines right now, but nothing wrong with a little umami afterbite, I guess. Up next, it's the Baker's Corner with Brittany Barton-Laban, the pastry chef from the Dahlia Bakery, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Our next guest is a pastry chef from the Dahlia Bakery, Brittany Barton-Laban.
Ooh, well done.
Wow, that was very sexy.
That was good, huh?
Yeah, that's the chef in the chapeau talking there. I'm Tom Douglas. Brittany is joining us. Should you love milk and white chocolate?
Yes, you should.
There's a lot of controversy.
Together
out there.
Or separated?
One is considered hip, like bittersweet, and the others are considered kind of trashy.
Yeah.
So
and I'm here in defense.
How'd this happen?
I think it happened the way it happened with me is that gross bunny that I got in my Easter basket every year, that white chocolate bunny that literally like activates my gag reflex.
That is not really white chocolate.
It's just garbage is what it is. So I think there's a lot of snobs
out
there.
You just killed the Easter bunny?
It was this waxy, gross Easter bunny I got in my Easter basket every year.
Trash
it's
Easter
disgusting.
Bunny. Wow.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, Russell Stover is not going to be very happy with you.
No, I don't even know that it was that. It's probably from the grocery store, but from Russell Stover.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's some really, really good white chocolates out there, and I'm here to talk about them.
So you are saying there's a good reason why they got a trashy reputation.
Yes.
And now you're saying that if you look for the right ones, you can find a good
version.
Okay.
Correct. Just like anything else, there's good and there's bad. Mm-hmm. So white chocolate, it's not chocolate. It's a confection made from cocoa butter, which is just as much the part of the cocoa bean as the cocoa solids.
So it is chocolate.
So it is chocolate. It just doesn't have the chocolate solids in it.
Okay.
But the cocoa bean is made up of about equal parts cocoa butter and the cocoa nib. And the nib is what we make cocoa powder. That's what we make.
Right.
So that's what's left over from that is cocoa butter. What they then
and it comes
do,
out clear like that?
No, it's actually kind of waxy and yellow looking.
Okay.
So then what they go and do to it is they do something called deodorizing it. And that's because cocoa butter is often used as a cosmetic, and mm-hmm. they don't want it smelling like chocolate.
Mm-hmm. I think it's that'd also, be super hot if it's not.
See, I'd be okay with that, too, but some people aren't.
Are you wearing Valrhona?
But then they just a good white chocolate is just that cocoa butter that's then had milk and sugar and vanilla added to it. Those are all good things, mm-hmm. right? Often what's happening with the lesser white chocolates is they then add a lot of oils and waxes to it to stretch that cocoa butter, because that cocoa butter is a high-demand product, and mm-hmm. it's expensive. Some of the really, really good high-end white chocolates will not deodorize that cocoa butter. So there's a brand called El Rey, I believe, so mm-hmm. you really get those lovely aromatic qualities from the chocolate. What I like to use white chocolate in is in places where I want to use an ingredient that I'm sort of nervous to put it in a sweet application, such as chilies or smoky flavors or herbs that I would normally think are too...
Or strong bitter.
Bitter flavors, exactly. Those are usually going to be good with white chocolate.
Right.
My thinking is if it's good with chocolate, it'll be good with white chocolate. If it's not good with chocolate, try it with white chocolate. For instance, blueberries. I don't particularly like blueberries and a dark chocolate. It's just not a flavor combination.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, or cream cheese. I don't particularly like cream cheese and dark chocolate. But those are both really delicious with white chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really cool things you can do with white chocolate. You can chop it up and put it in a really low oven and caramelize it. And that is
really
delicious.
I've never tried
that. Yeah, that's...
You simply put it on a cookie sheet or in a pan?
Yes. Yeah, we use a Silpat in the pastry kitchen mm-hmm. just to make sure it's not a big sticky mess. But we're talking like a 200-degree oven. So at home, you might want to go even lower and just leave it in there for a little while. And it turns this sort of... caramelized.
It's almost the idea of the tres leche idea
exactly.
where you go and slowly
yeah.
cook it down and caramelize it.
Yeah. The condensed milk idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So you can caramelize it in the oven, and if you catch it soon enough, you then can go and put that over the stove and melt it down. So you've got this caramelized...
Now, wait a second. So mm-hmm. you put the chunks in the oven. Are you saying they don't melt in the oven?
Well, it's weird. White chocolate melts a little oddly.
Yeah.
So if they will actually melt, but then when you pull it out of the oven, they'll set back up.
Even though the toasted... Mm-hmm. Caramel
yeah.
color?
Yeah. 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 So then you go and take that.
It's much more gummy of a texture, like a one piece kind of idea.
Exactly. And then from there, you can go and put it in a bain-marie or double boiler, right. and it will melt and be smooth. I learned this from the Icelandic event that we participate in every year. A couple years ago, the chef who was doing that had all these really cool things she was doing with white chocolate. So one of the things was putting it in the oven and caramelizing it and then melting it down over a double boiler and making a mousse out of that. And then another thing she did with that same product is after caramelizing in the oven, letting it set back up and then chopping it. And so mm-hmm. it became this like powdery crumble type. It's yeah. just a fantastic garnish.
Huh.
Yeah.
And always sweet garnish, or does it get a bitter, you know, like when you do yeah. onions and you take them to a bitter spot?
That's exactly, you get a little bit of a bitterness uh-huh. from the caramel that...
So you could use it in savory
absolutely.
Then, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
actually
yeah.
is very, it's really good to do with white chocolate, because white chocolate always reminds me of sugar.
Yes.
You know, it's very, very yes. sweet.
Yeah.
So to add another layer of flavor mm-hmm. to that chocolate is absolutely magnificent.
Yeah, yeah. We had a rep from... Provista, one of our food suppliers, come and do a tasting of white chocolate with us a while ago, and there was this chocolate from a company called Republica del Cacao, and they, all of their stuff is in the Andes, and they make white chocolate with cows that are grass-fed, and the chocolate itself had this almost greenish hue to it from these grass-fed cows, and when you'd taste it, you could almost taste the grassy notes from the milk. And so if you find a white chocolate that has interesting, like, you can do non-dairy milks with white chocolate, right, or some to do a goat's milk or something like that. There's some really, really nice chocolates out there that are being used with, or so, made with white chocolate.
So to start from back to the beginning, the most important part is to find a good white chocolate. Spend the money,
buy it from a chocolatier or a high-end grocery store.
And then if you like white chocolate, or you think you like white chocolate, you're going to be very surprised.
Yes, absolutely.
When I opened Cafe Sport a million years ago as the chef, we had a white and dark chocolate mousse on the menu at the time. Mm-hmm. And you would have thought like I was a genius guy. Because people had never really had white chocolate mousse. And I put the two together, and it was an interesting combination. It was by far our best-selling dessert.
Yeah.
It really works in much the same way as... Is there any place where white doesn't work like dark chocolate?
No. It's a little more difficult
It's more difficult to make a mousse with white chocolate than it is with dark chocolate.
Why?
You have to put some kind of a gelatin binder or some kind of a holder.
Because of all of the milk in there, it doesn't set up as firm as a dark chocolate.
There's a recipe in Rover's cookbook, if you can find it on Amazon, that is flawless.
Yeah.
It's a middle name.
But no, you can temper white chocolate. You can do all of those things. It's just it melts a little more quickly because of all the milk in there. And then it also, it melts a little weird sometimes. If you try and melt it at too high of a temperature, it can clump up.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you can use it just the same. My advice would be, if you're interested in experimenting with white chocolate and a unique flavor combination, maybe black cardamom or something like that, try it in a truffle, because you're going to really experience it.
Oh, yeah, just put it in a glass.
Just put it in a glass.
I stopped using white chocolate in a savory way years ago. Mm-hmm. I had a guest chef at Cafe Sport from Jordan Winery, and at that time, Jordan Winery was the hot restaurant.
That's a long time ago.
The hot winery in the country, right? So this is back in the mid-80s, and he made a white chocolate sauce for the rabbit that he was serving, and that was enough for me. I didn't need to do that again. But now that you say that you can kind of roast it and caramelize it and make it bitter and make it crumble, you know, on a bed of like hot stir-fried noodles, like with some chili in it, a crumble of that kind of bittersweet white chocolate on top sounds pretty darn good.
Yeah, I mean, you'd want some sweetness in there anyway. So.
If you remember, once I did a foie gras dinner at Rover's where you were there, and I gave you a chocolate mousse with foie gras in it. It was white chocolate.
Well, yeah, you were trying to be funny, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
That's kind of good.
But it was actually good. It was not, like, gross. It was
I had to eat it. You didn't have to eat it.
And you're still here to talk about it.
And then white chocolate in cookies, you don't have to worry about it melting in a different way.
No, chocolate.
Okay. Yeah. We didn't get the milk chocolate today. I want to talk about that, because that has somewhat... over the years, gotten a bit of a trashy reputation. I think Fran has rescued it.
Thank you, Fran.
Yeah, yes. Thank you, Fran.
Yeah.
She's rescued many things.
Yes, I know. She does a beautiful job, I think, with milk chocolate.
Yes, she does.
And that's... It feels legit again.
So. Yeah.
A good milk chocolate is probably one of my favorite chocolates, but there's not many great ones out there. It's hard to find
it's
good...
It's the same with a white chocolate. Yeah. Read your ingredients. It should just be... Well, in the case of milk chocolate, it should be just cocoa solids, milk, sugar, and lecithin. That's going to bind everything together. But that should be it.
Lecithin,
thank you.
And the same in white chocolate?
Same with white chocolate. Okay. Yep. Minus the cocoa solids.
All right.
Yeah.
That's Brittany Bartleben. I think we'll bring in a chocolate manufacturer next time from
great.
Theo.
Yeah.
And we could all kind of sit and chat them up and find out the secrets of making great chocolate. That's Brittany Bartleben, pastry chef at Dahlia Lounge and Dahlia Bakery. And we're going to move into our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Are you going to stay with us?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here at the Hot Stove Society. We've worn out our audience. They got a little sandwich, and now they're falling asleep. but they are all excited to participate in the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Lounge and Dahlia Bakery is here to succumb to our intelligence, Chef.
I'm but not going to do that. No way. I never, ever do that.
If we tag team her, we'll take her down.
I know, but that's not... You can't call it a head. You might actually bruise yourself.
Oh, believe me,
I'm
I know.
Nothing.
I know all about that. Sean, you're going to be our administrator today. Is that true?
That is true, yes.
And how do you feel about this chance for fame and fortune?
I feel like it's a great opportunity for me to move up and on and, you know, just really get out there.
Sarah moved up and on. Katie moved up and on.
I know.
So we can't lose you, too. All right.
So, yeah, I think everyone here knows how to do this thing. I've got some questions for you. 5 each. If you get them all right, you're the winner, of course. But then if you get them wrong, you lose. Whoever is the biggest loser today has to give away something, too. Nathan and Donna, his mom, Donna. Nathan was here with a question about figs. He has an abundance, an overabundance of figs, and we helped him try to figure out what to do with those.
We should.
Okay, you got the show. Okay.
Forget about it.
Hey.
Should we give his number just in case somebody else wants figs?
Sure, yeah. We'll have to talk to him off air. So, Terry, what are you going to give away to Nathan and his mother, Donna?
I mean, both of them. I think I should bring them to brunch at Luke. I've been trying to do that for a few weeks now. So,
but you're so smart.
No, I'm not smart. I'm just lucky. Brunch at Luke on a Saturday or a Sunday. Two of you. Come on in.
Sounds good.
All right, Tom, what about yourself?
Well, Nathan looks like he loves a garden and vegetables, so I'm going to send him over to the Carlisle Room for dinner for two at the Carlisle Room, $100 value, and maybe he can take in a show afterwards. You know, there's a bunch of shows coming. Big shows.
Okay. Isn't Wicked coming out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love that.
And Miss Brittany, what are you going to give away if you are the biggest loser today?
I'm going to do a $50 gift card to the Dahlia Bakery and the copy of our Dahlia Bakery cookbook.
Nice.
Sweetness
nice. So we can stop
signed.
Making
the signed. 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 Yes, absolutely.
All right. Terry, you usually go first. You want to stick with that?
Sure. Let's keep the tradition going.
All right. Let's see here. We've got what is Buddha's hand? Is it a type of candied ginger, a semi-tropical citrus fruit, or a Thai vegetarian dish?
Okay, I'm going to go with the, what's number two? How did you say that?
How are you doing over there, Terry?
I said that a long time ago. I can see why you don't remember that.
Go for it.
Semi-tropical citrus fruit.
Yeah, I go with that.
All right, that's correct.
I was trying to repeat what he said, but I couldn't remember what he said.
We got that.
Oh, yeah, we figured that out.
Yeah.
What is aquaculture? The genetic makeup of a school of fish, a fermenting agent added to salt water to make it potable? Or the practice of fish farming?
I would go with number three.
Fish farming, that's correct. Nice job. Number three here, which alcohol is not present in a Long Island iced tea? Rum, vodka, or gin? Which one of those is not present?
God, I've never had one of those. I heard they were brutal, though. I always go with, I guess, gin.
Incorrect.
Okay.
The rum.
The rum. There is no rum in Long Island iced tea?
Hey, that's what Top Chef quiz says.
Okay. Well, I will go with that.
All right. Number four. What difference between dark meat and light meat makes it difficult to cook poultry whole?
Well, dark meat takes longer to cook than white meat.
Yes, that is true.
But what's the difference?
That is the difference.
That is the difference, that the dark meat and the light meat cook at different rates.
I thought there was some scientific...
I know, right?
That is scientific.
Yeah.
Okay, you ready?
For Monday.
You ready? Today's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
Oh, that's even better.
That's why I couldn't understand what Buddha's hand was.
But this is airing on Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. Weird. Okay, Terry. Pomme dauphine are what shape? Thin slices, round balls, or perfect one-inch cubes?
They are round balls.
All right.
I made millions of those when I was an apprentice.
You know about round balls, right?
I would have said thin slices, honestly.
I would too.
No, they're round balls, and they're actually mashed potato with pata choux rolled into a flour and bread crumb and then deep fried.
Nice.
I've made so many of those, I could lose my mind thinking about it.
Well, Terry, you got 4 out of 5 there.
Thank you.
Nice job, Chef.
Good job.
All right.
All right. Tom or Brittany?
I'll go next.
Brittany, all right. Number one for you. The Russian specialty pancakes called blini are traditionally made with what type of flour?
Buckwheat.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Ooh. All right.
Why are they in such a hurry?
What?
They're Russian.
Nice.
He's on fire today.
Yeah, there you go. In what state are true Vidalia onions grown?
Where's my multiple choice?
Okay, I'll give you a multiple choice. Right. Let's see. Is it Washington State, Georgia, or New York City?
New York State of mind.
Let's go with Georgia.
That is correct.
All right.
Yeah.
Hey, you lucky
thanks for that
dog.
Help.
You
was it Georgia, Georgia, or Georgia?
Georgia.
What is the name of the clarified butter traditionally used in Indian dishes?
Ghee.
Yes, correct.
G-H-E-E.
Oh, all right.
Oh, she's
nice
3-4-3. She's killing it.
Nipping at your heels.
All right, number 4. What vegetable, often paired with strawberries, is also known as pie plant?
Rhubarb.
Oh.
Nice.
You're like giving Terry a French question.
I know.
Potato
stuffing.
Yeah.
Okay, your last question here, Brittany. What is the most consumed root vegetable in the United States?
Oh, we've had this question before, and I was wrong.
Go ahead, be wrong again.
Yeah. Go ahead,
no
be
harm.
Wrong. Be wrong. We want mine. Taro
do you
root.
Have a multiple choice for me?
I could. Yeah, sure.
Sure, why not?
Okay, root vegetable.
Turnips, we'll parsnips, and taro root.
Well, one of those isn't even on here.
I know. That was the idea. I was trying to steer the wrong way.
Okay, so parsnips, root...
taro root.
Taro root and a potato.
Let's go with potato.
Nice. Hey, you got 5 out of 5.
Yay!
Wow. I am I'm shaking in my boots over here.
Tom Douglas, number 1, which are larger, sea scallops or bay scallops?
Well, the sea is larger than the bay, so I'll go with sea scallops.
Good logic.
Sea scallops.
Thank
correct.
You for that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where does the color and flavor of honey come from? The type of bee or the type of nectar the bee feeds on?
I'll go with the type of bee.
The type of nectar.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You ready for number 3?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What is the Spanish version of the Franche creme caramel?
Flan.
Yes.
Nice. Right.
You and I are still tied there, buddy.
Nippa.
All right, two
more.
2 out of
3.
Which month translates in the Cherokee language as hungry month because it falls during a time of year when few or no crops are growing?
January, February, March, April.
It's one of those 4.
I'll say January.
I'll say February.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
All right. It's 2-2, so you need to either get this one right or wrong.
What's growing in January?
I've already lost.
What's growing in January
that
doesn't grow in February?
I don't know, man. Okay. How many cups are in a quart?
4.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
All right. So that
but
means,
I still lose.
Yeah, Terry. Oh, yeah. You're the loser.
Thank you. Yes, Terry.
And I'm winning at life.
Congratulations to Nathan and Donna. You got, I think it's congratulations. Depends if you like the food or not. You get dinner for $200 value at the Carlisle Room across from the Paramount Theater. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening, or buy a ticket. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. And our sound engineer and quiz host is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can podcast our show through Apple, Stitcher, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.